Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
All right. Growing up in the 80s and with over 20 years of leadership experience in corporate marketing, Chris Clues knew three things very well. 80s, pop culture, business, and the crazy thing we call life. Now, one day he was watching The Breakfast Club and The Outsiders, and he got some ideas on what to do with his life. He created the popular book series, The Ultimate Series on Essential Work and Life Lessons from 80s Pop Culture, which includes two volumes, What 80s Pop Culture Teaches Us About Today's Workplace, and his latest title, Raised on the 80s, 30-plus Unexpected Life Lessons from the Movies and Music that Defined Pop Culture's Most Excellent Decade. And to talk about that journey is Chris Clues. Chris, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing great, Dave. Thank you so much for having me. Well, I really appreciate it.
Well, I will tell you, we both grew up in the 80s, so I kind of get where you're coming from in all this. But talk about the journey and how you kind of turned this into a professional career.
Yeah, so I was in corporate marketing for 20-plus years and just was in a job that wasn't really working out for me. And I was having a self-pity party of one at home, and I was watching The Breakfast Club. And for the first time in my life, I really heard and listened to this line by John Bender when he said, screws fall out all the time. The world's an imperfect place. Mm-hmm. And my screws have fallen out. I was in an imperfect place. And I thought, am I just going to put those same screws back in and go down the same journey? As Henry David Thoreau said, the mass of men or the mass of people lead lives of quiet desperation. That was my place. And I decided to get a whole new set of screws and walk out to an entirely new journey. And then The Outsiders came on. Johnny Cate said, you still have a lot of time to make yourself be what you want. And I was 46. I wasn't a young entrepreneur, wasn't old, but wasn't young. And I took those two lines to heart. And now I sit in front of you today, or I talk to you today, with three books in my series, as you mentioned. I'm a keynote speaker on this idea of life and work lessons from 80s pop culture.
Yeah, and it's not just about the movies, it's the music too. And maybe it's because I grew up in that decade, you know, at least through high school and college, like, it was pretty impactful. I think there were great moments in time in the music industry and the movie industry, but also in pop culture in general, right?
Yeah, I mean, I talk about pop culture. I explain it in the 80s, of course, as kind of like somebody took a glitter bomb and threw it against the wall and it exploded and all of these wonderful colors came out. And yeah, that was like the creativity and individuality of 80s pop culture, which I don't think we saw before. I mean, I'm confident we didn't see before. And I don't think we're ever going to see replicated, which is why still today, you know, 43 years removed from 1980, it's as strong as ever in terms of influence.
Let's talk a little bit about the music first, because we're leading into a conversation we're going to have tonight with, you know, some of the Rat Packers, Anthony Michael Hall, Andrew McCarthy, Ali Sheedy, coming up tonight. So this is a great lead-in conversation. So we will talk about the movies, but let's talk about some of the music that really defined the decade and what you got out of that.
Yeah, so I have a great lesson from a musician who loved The Color Purple. But I think there's another great thing about the music in the 80s, and that is that if you go back, I challenge people when I speak at conferences, I challenge people to go look at Google any week of any month of any year in the 80s, top 40. And what you'll see is you'll see this variety of music. So it may be like a Depeche Mode next to an LL Cool J, next to a Kenny Rogers, and then we'll throw in like a Debbie Gibson, and then let's throw in Poison. And so you have all these different genres of music, but they were all in the top 10 or top 20 at the same time. And that was what I think made the music great.
We are talking to Chris Clues. His book is Raised on the 80s, 30-plus Unexpected Life Lessons. And there's more with him next on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer, 720 WGN. We're talking to Chris Clues, and his book is Raised on the 80s, 30-plus Unexpected Life Lessons from the Movies and Music that Defined Pop Culture's Most Excellent Decade. And again, I think those of us who grew up in that decade truly, truly believe that, for sure. But you talk about, I want to get to some of the John Hughes movies in a little bit, because we'll be talking to Andrew McCarthy and Anthony Michael Hall and Ali Sheedy coming up in the next hour and a half. But you know, one of the early 80s movies you talk about, you know, Trading Places, which was Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd, who I just had on. And you know, it really teaches you some really unique life lessons, doesn't it?
It really does. And yeah, Dan Aykroyd, Jamie Lee Curtis, Eddie Murphy, what a phenomenal cast. Don Ameche, you know. So, yeah, I focus on Billy Ray Valentine, which was Eddie Murphy's character. And one of the really valuable lessons in the movie is that we all see he's a very smart guy from the beginning. He just hasn't been given maybe the opportunities that somebody else like Lewis Winthorpe III, played by Dan Aykroyd, has been given. When he gets that opportunity, and he's going to be a commodities broker, the very first day he's looking at the building, and he's, you know, he's intimidated, like a lot of us are when we take these big jobs. And he looks at Coleman, the butler, and he says, what if I can't do this job? What if I'm not what they expected? And Coleman says, just be yourself, sir. They can't take that away from you. Now, if that was just the only lesson, be yourself, important one. But it goes deeper than that. We've seen that we know that he can do this job. Billy Ray just doesn't have that confidence yet. Or hasn't thought about it in that context. And so what I say is that confident people question themselves, arrogant people question others. And what I mean by that is the way that you get better, if you're confident in what you do, is you do question yourself. Because once you stop questioning yourself, if something goes wrong, where do you go?
That's true.
You look to point it out to somebody, well, it must have been this person's fault. So there's a really important lesson there about confident people question themselves and arrogant people question others.
Field of Dreams.
Field of Dreams. Just the fact that here's a guy, Ray Kinsella, who is a farmer and is kind of learning how to do it, and he's struggling. And he's struggling to help his family. And he hears the voices, as we all know, and builds this baseball diamond in the cornfields. And it's a crazy thing that he does. Now, Annie, his wife, is completely supportive of him. It's very important to have a supportive partner, and regardless of what you do, even if it is crazy like he did. And at one point in the movie, they're sitting having a glass of wine out in the middle of the field, and he says, I've just done something totally illogical.
Right.
And she says, it's a beautiful baseball diamond, Ray. Yeah. And the lesson here is that, you know, where we get creative and progress and innovation is from the illogical. Logical is important for roads and bridges. We need those, of course. But where we advance in society and where we get our technological advances and our progress is typically from the illogical. So I talk about how it's good to be illogical. If you're being called crazy, it's probably a good thing.
Two coming-of-age movies. I love that you found a life lesson out of Fast Times at Ridgemont High. It's probably still one of my favorite movies as a teenager. But, yeah, talk about that life lesson.
Yeah, Jeff Spicoli. And there's a great backgrounder. The history of Fast Times is amazing. But I focus on Jeff Spicoli, played by Sean Penn, and his relationship with Mr. Hand, the American history teacher, who as a kid, I have to say, the greatest decision I ever made as a 12, 13-year-old kid, I bought a ticket to E.T. and I snuck into Fast Times. Greatest decision ever.
I love that. Yeah, love that. Love that.
And that's where I found my love of Vans. But Jeff Spicoli, at one point, he's late to class again, and Mr. Hand says, why are you always late to my class? And Spicoli says, I don't know. And Mr. Hand says, I like that. I don't know. I'm going to put it on my chalkboard for all my classes to see, giving you full credit. Now, in this idea of I don't know, I often say, how many times have you been asked a question in your work and you didn't know the answer? Well, if you say never, then in the words of the church lady, isn't that special? But for the rest of us, we've all been asked a question. In the past, we've been told, never say I don't know, make something up. But, you know, saying I don't know is a sign of weakness and vulnerability. And I say nonsense. It's a sign of strength and confidence and character to say I don't know. It's honest. It's transparent. And then you just have to caveat it with, and I'll get back to you in the time frame that's appropriate for the job or the life situation that you have in front of you. But it's okay to say, I don't know.
You know, we talk so much about work-life balance today. It was really an early lesson from Ferris Bueller.
Yeah, of course. The life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop to look around once in a while, you could miss it. And he certainly stopped and looked around and took that day off, that ninth day off. Really important lesson about work-life balance. And it goes deeper than that as well, just like a lot of the lessons I talk about too. I saw something a little bit more in that you have Sloan and Ferris, two of the most optimistic people in the world, and then Cameron, his best friend, who couldn't be more pessimistic. So they take this day off, they plan it, we see how much planning goes into it, but they invite Cameron. Why? Because Cameron needed it more than they did.
True.
And they were willing to have their day ruined to make sure that their friend could experience something positive.
1987's Can't Buy Me Love. And I love this too, because it's something we talk about today about materialism versus experiences. And I think I probably learned that later in life too, that I don't want another gift wrapped up. I want to go do something with somebody and hang out and do something cool with somebody I want to spend time with, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And Can't Buy Me Love has several great lessons in it, on top of the fact that, you know, Patrick Dempsey went from, you know, the nerdy kid riding the lawnmower to Dr. McDreamy, so anything is possible, I suppose.
That's funny. It's so funny. It's true.
But you're right. So in Can't Buy Me Love, we talk about the idea of the difference between experiences and things that we we purchase. And I ask people, I challenge people to say, like, think about when you were 18 years old and something that you purchased that meant so much to you at the time. Now, you know, excluding, like, if you're like a car person, you got, you know, your first car. But something like a bike, I talk about a bike, for example, that I really wanted versus an experience that I had. And how many details can I tell you about that bike versus that experience? And I say that doing the thing is greater than buying the thing. And this is something we learn when he buys the dress for her, of course, and becomes her boyfriend through this little payment. But ultimately, at the end of the movie, what we see is that it was the experience. It wasn't the kind of buying the relationship thing. It was the experience that he got out of it, and that doing the thing is greater than buying the thing.
I like what you found out of Die Hard here, which is still arguably, people say it's a Christmas movie. We can do that. We can shelve that for another time. But it for you, it was, okay, obviously it's tough, challenging situations, but handling those type of situations with a little humor.
Yeah. Christmas movie, Hollis Queens at the end of the movie. So absolutely. I say that, you know, the best way to face a challenge is with some levity and humor. And we see that with John McClane when he's stuck in the AC vent and he has no shoes and there's terrorists shooting at him. And he didn't expect this for the holiday party. But this is the situation that he's in. And he starts kind of mocking his wife a little bit. He says, you know, come out to the coast. We'll have some laughs. And then he says, now I know what a TV dinner feels like, because for those of us that grew up with TV dinners, right. He's stuck in this AC vent. So what is he doing? This is a very challenging situation, but he's approaching it with levity and humor. And we all face challenges. I had a really rough patch for about 100 days where, you know, I lost a couple important women in my life, my stepmom and my mom, all in 100 days. And my sister and I went through it, and we really tried to go through the situation with some levity and humor, because it was the only way to really survive it mentally.
Right.
So, yeah, really important lesson from John McClane.
Let's talk about some of these coming-of-age Rat Pack movies, Breakfast Club, 16 Candles. What would you – the Breakfast Club is simple, isn't it?
It's so simple. I got to say, like, I'm still waiting. I wish I had the status to be able to get the rights to it, because I think as a Broadway play, it's perfectly set for Broadway.
Yeah.
For theater. So it's a very simple concept, but it's these five kids from different walks of life who all end up being forced to spend time together and get to know each other. That's really the crux of the story. And of course, the age-old struggle that teenagers have with their parents. And so I have a lesson from every character, including Principal Vernon and Carl the janitor, because they are both very important as well. I think for our conversation here, you're going to be talking to Anthony Michael Hall. So his character, Brian the Brain, is a really important character, because he's kind of shunned by the other kids, because what is the Brain doing here? How did he get in trouble? And they, you know, the walk on by in the hallway type of thing from, you know, Simple Minds, Don't You Forget About Me. But he's really important, because as we get to know him and they get to know him, we see that his real personality comes out. We see him challenge authority. You know, could you describe the ruckus, sir? That type of stuff. And I talk about how, like, the really cool stuff in human beings is beneath the surface. And so, I could talk about how I use the analogy of the beach and the ocean, and how the deeper you go into the ocean, the cooler the stuff gets. Well, the same kind of thing with humans. We only see that surface, but the deeper we go, the cooler the things are. Really important lesson.
It's true. Any other John Hughes movies? I mean, there's so, you know, obviously so many of them filmed here in Chicago, so they're near and dear to my heart. What else do you see in some of those other movies?
Oh, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Oh.
I mean, that's one of my favorites of all time. I mean, just a fantastic movie, and really miss John Candy. So Del Griffith, I talk about the idea of Del Griffith and how when we talk about businesses and companies and we talk about what makes them great, we often talk about the product, the service, the brand, the leadership. All of these things are really, really important. But the one thing you never hear, and it's really odd to me, is that every great company needs great salespeople or a great salesperson, like Del Griffith, who sold shower curtain rings as earrings to people at a bus station so that they could get on their way.
Right.
And I think it's a really important lesson that we forget, because whether you're a company of one or 100,000, there's really no way to grow without great salespeople.
It's true.
And so I talk about this idea of Del Griffith and what he teaches us about what's important for a business to grow.
Well, totally awesome book, Raised on the 80s, 30-plus unexpected life lessons from the movies and music that define pop culture's most excellent decade. Chris, thanks for spending some time with us and sharing your insight on all this.
Dave, thank you so much. And stay rad, everybody.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you. All right, we're going to continue the 80s conversation with Anthony Michael Hall, Andrew McCarthy, Ali Sheedy, and more after the news next here on 720 WGN. All right, Anthony Michael Hall has made an impression and an impact on many generations as we grew up with movies like National Lampoon's Vacation, 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club, Weird Science, and countless other movies. He starred for 6 seasons in the USA Network's The Dead Zone. His recent work includes co-starring with Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween Kills, ABC's The Goldbergs, Netflix's War Machine with Brad Pitt, Live by Night with Ben Affleck, and to talk about his journey is Anthony Michael Hall. Hey there, Anthony.
Hey, Dave. Good to be with you today. Thank you for that great setup. Much appreciated.
Absolutely. Thank you for taking the time. You know, the public probably sees you in your first memorable role as Rusty in Vacation, but you've been acting since you were eight. What got you started in the business? Like, what got you in the business at 8 years old?
You know what, Dave? It's actually kind of surreal. Here I am at this age, and I started 45 years ago at the tender age of eight, and I actually did a play with the late, great Steve Allen, another legend.
I know, it's
the privilege of working with as a young man.
Yeah,
and I was doing a play with him all those years ago, and that was my first job in 1976, and that was kind of a theater production that toured the summer stock circuit in the Northeast. So, yeah, you know, it's very surreal to me. I've been working, you know, for this many years, but I feel very privileged and very blessed that I've had, you know, a long career. And even as a young kid, that was always the goal, you know, to aim for longevity, to stay consistent and keep chipping away at it, as my father would say.
You played a young Steve Allen. By the way, Steve Allen was raised on the south side of Chicago here, and your first screen appearance was in a TV movie called The Goldbug. You played Edgar Allan Poe. 82 was a first notable movie with Six Pack with Kenny Rogers and Diane Lane, but that big break came when you were Rusty in the original National Lampoon's Vacation, and John Hughes was a screenwriter. He wasn't directing, wasn't producing on that film, but you certainly caught his attention.
You do great research, sir. That's why you're you. I mean, that's exactly right. You know, right. John was, he was fantastic, and what happened was, you know, if fans of his work remember She's Having a Baby with Kevin Bacon, Elizabeth McGovern, that was one of the pictures he did in the 80s. You know, that was really John's story. So in that film, mm-hmm. Kevin was playing John. He was an advertising guy that grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. And he was writing copy, you know, for an advertising agency, and he started sending stories into National Lampoon magazine. So that's how his career began. So Vacation 58, as it was called, was an article, you know, a piece that he'd written for Lampoon magazine, and it really took off. You know, it was kind of like on a whim that he decided to go for it and start sending in his own original written work when he wasn't writing ads during the day. And he had a great wife, his lovely wife, Nancy Hughes, who's no longer with us, unfortunately, as well. But so that's how we started. So it's a really interesting thing. We were sort of intertwined from the beginning, Dave, because, you know, it was my good fortune. I had a great opportunity to work with this great artist. And so I did not meet him on Vacation. And then after that, I auditioned for 16 Candles as a kid in New York City where I was raised. And then that led to Breakfast Club and Weird Science, which he just kind of handed to me. You know, so it was an incredible collaboration. And to be fair, it wasn't just me and me. I all the actors that he helped discover, he really created a great working environment. He was always collaborative. He was always encouraging, and he was just a great friend, and he loved to laugh. He loved the music. You know, when we were here shooting those movies, he would pick me up on the weekends and Molly, and we'd go to record stores, and we'd go to blues bars, all kinds of stuff. He was just fantastic. You know, he was a great guy to work with.
Well, and plus you were working with Chevy, who was really at the pinnacle of his career. And, you know, and the cast was phenomenal, but Imogene Coca, like, I don't think there's a generation that really knows who she was as an actress early on in the first days of television. But I mean, she made with your shows, you know, that was the first variety show, was, you know, call it an inspiration for what we see in Saturday Night Live and other improv shows today. But, you know, pretty cool that they chose her, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely, Dave. And the truth is that was the original SNL, as you well know. I mean, it was before our time and era, but, you know, it was one of the first sort of live comedy shows, and she was just a wonderful lady to work with, really kind, and I loved working with her. And, of course, the great John Candy and, I mean, Bill Murray's brother, Brian Dole Murray, another group of, you know, another family of legends from the local area here in Chicago. So it was just such a privilege to work with all these people as a kid. I looked up to all of them. I learned from them all, and I just had such a blast, especially on Vacation as well. It was a great experience. Because we actually made that trip. This is long before CGI and everything being digital. Right. So, yeah, just incredible opportunities I had as a kid. I'm really, really thankful for them.
Well, you were a young teen, too. So, you know, you were in a growing spurt. So what I've heard, what I've read, and you can tell me if this is fact or not, is that, you know, your various heights through this film, because it doesn't take 5 minutes to film something. And when you're a 14, 15-year-old kid, you know, you're going through puberty, so to speak, and you're growing, right. You know, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that, because over the years I would joke with my parents, and in retrospect, and I would tell them, you know what, it was like doing, you know, I call it the puberty on film trilogy, you know, the films I did with John. It was really funny, you know. And, you know, when it first all happened for me, it was really amazing. It was a bit daunting. It was scary. You know, you're suddenly being recognized everywhere, but I just felt so privileged, and I've always just, you know, counted my blessings, because it's really been a great career. I'm really fortunate to have worked with the people that we've discussed. And also, you know, it was a great, you know, foundation for me as a kid growing up as well.
I heard Hoover mention the fact that, you know, this was an R-rated film. This is only a couple of John Hughes films were ever rated R, but there was some nudity scenes in there, and you were a young kid, so you were quickly shuffled off the stage, weren't you?
My hormones are raging, as we all were at 14, right? So, yeah, there was a couple instances. It was actually a scene where we were doing that spoof of the Psycho
film. The shower.
Beverly was, yeah, exactly. She was in the shower, and I'll let the audience go from there. But it was funny. I tried to sneak on the set there. I was a bad little boy, I guess.
That's awesome.
And then Maddie Simmons, our great producer. Yeah, I got the boot.
Yes, you did. There's more with him next on 720 WGN. State player on 720 WGN. We're talking to Anthony Michael Hall. Probably grew up with him in classic movies like The Breakfast Club and 16 Candles. We just talked a little bit about John Hughes, and you were cast in what was his directorial debut, and that was 16 Candles. But he wrote that role just for you, didn't he?
You know what? I think he did. He kind of had me in mind after I'd done Vacation as a kid, and he really liked the work I'd done. And as we talked about earlier, you know, that was his first short story that he submitted to National Lampoon magazine. And then his career kind of took off. He wrote another classic with Michael Keaton, Mr. Mom, and some other films. And so 16 Candles represented the first opportunity where he was getting behind the lens and directing. And we shot the film right here in Chicago. We shot in Skokie and Evanston and all these great neighborhoods. And just great memories there. They really were. Because it was such a relaxed environment on set. He really created a great tone, you know. And as leaders, you know, with respect to leadership, you always want to lead by example. And he was just a fun-loving, good-hearted guy. And he really cared about everybody he worked with and created a great working environment for us all to flourish. You know, he was awesome.
I love that. You did spend a lot of time here. I mean, because at Breakfast Club, same thing. And was that a different, you know, film for you, a little more grown up, maybe from a character perspective, a little more depth maybe than what you were doing earlier on?
Yeah, you're spot on with that, Dave. It was. And we had just finished the Breakfast, 16 Candles. And then John told me, he called me one day. I was back in New York City, you know, living with my parents in Manhattan. And I got a call, and he told me about this project. And, you know, he just sort of gave me the role on the phone, and I was flabbergasted. I mean, again, I'm just a kid at the time. And we went back to Chicago, and we shot The Breakfast Club. And it's interesting, because I think it was based on a high school called New Trier here.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
I went to school, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
That's right.
So what we did is, I think we shot at, Glenbrook North. It was the high school, I think, that had been shut down at the time in the 80s. And, of course, you know, guys of our age group will remember the USFL. At the time, the Chicago Blitz, they were also sharing that school. So it was the funniest thing. We built our sets inside the gymnasium. And then I'd see Vince Evans and the boys walking down the hallway, you know, going to, you know, practice on the field, you know. So we kind of shared it with the football team.
That's great.
And, you know, that library set that was built was constructed inside of that high school. And it's just a great experience. That was the thing. We did those first two films here, and then on Weird Science, the deal that John had worked out with the studios, we started the picture here, and then we went back to L.A., and we filmed it, you know, all the interiors at Universal Studios on stage. So it was another great experience. And they were just three consecutive productions in a row. So over the course of, you know, 3 years, I had done these three films that
you have,
you know, live in the hearts of people, which is really awesome.
Well, you were offered Ferris Bueller, I believe, but, you know, did you just want to do something different and challenge yourself a bit more? Were you ready
I
for
did
something
at
else?
The time. It was partly that, and it was also kind of entangled on another project. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to do that. But, you know, that became a great hit for John, of course. And I, you know, of course, Matthew Broderick was fantastic in the film. And that was, as you know, shot here. So that was another great one. And then John was off to the races at that point. He had his own company and his own record label, and he just continued to do great work, with always the thread being the comedy, you know, characters that show their vulnerability, but somehow wind up a little better off than they started. So he was just, he really was brilliant. When I look back now, especially at this age, and I realize, you know, he was a young man still himself. He was only 30, you know, 35 to 38 doing all this great work, and just a great guy. You know, I miss him. I really do.
You were cast in a retool of SNL, youngest player ever at 17, and we're the same age, so I've followed you your entire career, but you know, Robert Downey Jr., Dennis Miller, Lovitz, Nora Dunn, Joan Cusack, Damon Wayans, that must have just been a head spinner for you, because it, how cool is it to be a part of that SNL legacy?
Well, Dave, you're right on the mark again. If you're, that's a perfect description. It was a head spinner, because by the time that happened, as you know, typically the trajectory for people that do that show is they start out in comedy or Second City, the great organization here, or, doing stand-up and such. So it usually works in reverse. You know, people work their butts off to get on that show or to be seen by, you know, the great Lorne Michaels who created it. And it kind of worked in reverse for me. I'd done these films, and I think that Lorne saw, some talent in me in terms of doing the comedy and all that, and I just had a great time doing it, but it was absolutely a head spinner, because a lot of people don't realize that show, you come in on a Monday, you start writing sketches, and as we know, like 30 Rock is based on that, but it's really that kind of environment where it's comedians, writers, it's just like, it's like summer stock theater meets rock and roll meets everything all rolled into one. So by Thursday, you're rehearsing the show around the clock for 2 days straight, even on Saturday, the third day of rehearsal, and then we tape the show twice, actually. You do it at 7:30 with one audience, and then they shuffle that audience out, and then we go live again. So it's really just a grind. It's an incredible amount of work each week that everybody does on that show. And as we know, over the years, now it's an institution. I mean, it's in its 48th season or whatever it is. And there have been so many great men and women that have just been explosive on that show, who've really gone on to great careers. Yeah, it's just fantastic.
No
so it's
question.
It's a real tribute and a real honor, tribute to Lorne, and a real honor to have been a part of it.
But at such a young age, so much success, how did you keep it all? How did you keep it all together?
It was difficult. Fortunately, I had great parents, and I was raised by a really tough, loving, Irish, Italian, Catholic mom. And so I had that foundation, of my faith, and also great parents, and just keeping it real. They always did that with me. So, a lot of the ideas of, things that pertain to sort of like playing the celebrity card, all that stuff was really never of interest to me. I just enjoyed the work. And I always had that, great family to go back to who taught me the right way, I'm so grateful for that now. Of course, we don't see that till we're older, but of course it was really so integral to my development.
It's awesome. You played a villain in Edward Scissorhands' challenging role in Six Degrees of Separation. You played Bill Gates in Pirates of Silicon Valley. So those roles truly started to pivot for you.
Yeah, that was an amazing experience again. I mean, I went into that audition to play Gates. It was a TNT film, Turner Network. Yeah, same thing. Back in 99. Mm-hmm. And it was a great director named Martin Burke. And I remember kind of going into that audition, kind of method acting style. I had the glasses on and I combed the hair, the side part like Mr. Gates has and the whole thing. And great experience, And the film went on to garner, I think, about 5 Emmy nominations. So it was a really... really interesting project for me, and I was very very fortunate to be a part of it.
Well, and you've done a ton of TV work as well, The Dead Zone, when you did the Goldbergs, and I loved, you've done more than one of them. I love showing my kids, because I've got kids in their teens and a little bit younger, and they have watched, they will watch The Breakfast Club and 16 Candles and everything, and I will find on my phone a picture of you then, or Vacation, and I'll be like, you see that guy right there? That's him right there. It's him right there.
Yeah, that's funny.
And how perfect on the 80s show. I mean, that's a great place to be,
right? Really was. I'm with a great company of managers, Jason Weinberg and Mitch Mason, and they were really kind enough to work on that deal for me. So they contacted ABC, and the first episode we did, Dave, was actually a spoof of Vacation. So the Goldbergs were going to get the vacation, to go on a vacation. They got to Disneyland. And now there's an irony here, which is in 1983 when we made the picture, it might have been 82, it was a Warner Brothers film, so we actually could not use Disneyland. And all these years later, I'm on the Goldbergs, and we're going back to Disneyland with the Goldbergs, and they had a really funny joke, which is they made Rusty Griswold like the security guard at Disneyland. So Rusty went on to wind up working at the gate at Disneyland, which
is
pretty funny.
Great.
And then from that, I had a blast working with Christie Brinkley and the whole cast. Then they created a high school counselor role that is a sort of a regular on the series. So I think I've done like 6 or 7 of them now.
Yeah.
So that's just a blast working on that show. Great cast.
They play a great tribute to what happened in that era. I mean, they're true to it.
Yeah, they really are.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, Wendy McClendon and Covey and Jeff Garland and all the kids on the show, I mean, they're fantastic. They really work hard and they have a lot of fun too. So it really, it's very much reminiscent of the John Hughes sets, because everybody has a laugh at work, and it's a really fortunate thing to be able to work on a hit show like that. Real nice.
Anthony, this was great fun.
Thanks. It's a real pleasure. And you're a gentleman. Thanks for this opportunity.
Thank you, sir. All right, take care. Most people know Andrew McCarthy from his movie roles in Pretty in Pink, St. Elmo's Fire, Weekend at Bernie's, and Less Than Zero, and is a charter member of Hollywood's Brat Pack. That group included Rob Lowe, Molly Ringwald, Emilio Estevez, and Demi Moore, and has come to represent both a genre of film and an era of pop culture. Andrew has also directed nearly 100 hours of television, including some of today's biggest hits, including The Blacklist, Grace and Frankie, New Amsterdam, Orange is the New Black, and he's acting too, most recently in NBC's Good Girls. And joining us to share that journey is Andrew McCarthy. Welcome in, Andrew.
Thanks. Good to be here.
You know, I have to say, and I grew up in that era, those movies were those coming-of-age films for me as well, that writing this might have been a deep, effective form of therapy to relive and think about that moment in time.
You know, I didn't think that going in.
Right.
It was just sort of a thing I'd never really looked at. You know, it was such a seminal moment in my life, those several years. And it was kind of something I just sort of ran from. And yet my whole life is an outgrowth of what happened in those several years. And to go back and look at it, it actually turned out to be kind of quite liberating. You're right. And to kind of own the past in a way that sure. I never really had before. It was an interesting experience.
Well, and in the book title, you know, uses brat, and I just thought it just meant, you know, cocky young kids, whatever. But it was, I didn't think it was unflattering, but it was New York Magazine that coined that phrase back when in a cover photo shoot for St. Elmo's Fire. They really didn't consider that flattering.
No, it was a crazy thing. It was originally meant to be like a small feature on Emilio for St. Elmo's Fire. And then this shows how naive the times were. Emilio or his publicist or someone said, why don't you bring the reporter out with you when you have a few drinks? I mean, can you imagine such a thing happening today? Anyway,
yeah.
And so anyway, he did with Rob Lowe and Judd Nelson. And the writer kind of turned off to his subject and wrote this kind of stinging indictment of them. And it was originally cast in this kind of really pejorative term. I mean, nobody wants to be called a brat, right? But you know, I don't know, like you mentioned, I don't think the public ever really took it that way, but it's certainly in Hollywood and in the movie business, it was sort of a very negative thing, and something a lot of us, myself included, tried to run from for a long time. And, you know, but those movies, like you're talking about, just sort of have become so iconic and representative of a moment for a generation, and that moment when, you know, the youth is just exploding and your life is becoming your own and your future is a blank slate to be written on. You know, it's such an exciting time in your life. And I've, you know, now become sort of an avatar of people,
right.
of that generation's youth, you know.
We're talking to actor, writer, and director Andrew McCarthy. And there's much more to talk about next on 720 WGN. State Flyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to actor, writer, and director Andrew McCarthy about his book, Brat, an 80s story. I want to jump back a little bit, you know, before college, you were already acting. You were in a play, Oliver, in your school. What brought you to the stage and even wanting to be an actor, even at that age?
No, you know, I was very lucky in the sense. Well, I was cut from the basketball team is the short answer.
Okay, fair.
My mother said, "Why don't you try out for the play, dear?" And I'm like, "I don't want to be in the play. I want to be the point guard." And anyway, I did, and I had one of those great experiences. I walked out on stage as the Artful Dodger in Oliver, and I totally felt like myself for the first time. It was one of those crazy experiences. Like, I was like, oh, there I am. And I knew it was a powerful experience because I told absolutely no one.
Gotcha.
Said, wow, something just happened, and that's mine, and I don't want anybody messing with it.
I love it.
So, but I knew that, like, okay, that's going to be my... And luckily, I was so young and stupid, the way we are, you don't know anything isn't possible. He said, I'm going to do that. I had no idea how I was going to do it, but I'm doing that. And I just sort of pointed myself in that direction inside. I mean, I had no wherewithal to do any of it, but inside, I said, that's what I'm doing, and I just went toward it.
Well, you're a movie buff, too, so, like, who did you look up to? Who did you say, yeah, that's a guy, I can be that guy?
Well, I didn't say I could be that guy to any of them because I couldn't imagine that, but I was enamored with Montgomery Clift, his old movies. And I was a big Al Pacino fan like everyone was back in the day. They're young. He was like royalty to a young actor. And I remember one night he was filming a movie across, right across the street from my apartment in New York. And I just remember standing outside watching every movie made and him going back and forth to his trail. And I'm like, oh, man, I want to do that so bad. And, you know, people like that who you never meet and they have no idea that you have they have such an effect on you.
You do have a Chicago connection. You were cast in your first movie, Class, with Rob Lowe, Jacqueline Bisset, and you wrote in the book, you know, it would have been narrowed down to four actors for the two lead roles. We're broken into pairs. I was teamed with an impossibly handsome young actor named Rob Lowe, who was auditioning to play my rich roommate and the son of a woman who my character would have an affair. I was back in a dizzy and disorienting world of what the hell is going on and how did I get here? And, you know, you're talking about wandering by a water tower place where you shot that love scene in the elevator. So you were right here in Chicago, first movie role, and a big one at that.
Yeah, and I've always had such an affection for Chicago because that just changed my life. It was the first time I'd really been away from home or New York, and it was an amazing, wondrous time. And I remember Rob and I just wandering through Water Tower Place and just sort of wandering around waiting for our audition and being so nervous and just sort of shuffling over the marble. And I remember it so clearly. And yeah, it was a great time. It was a great time.
And you continue to write, with filming in Chicago, when it wrapped up, I settled into the back bedroom of Jacqueline Bisset's Spanish bungalow in the Hollywood Hills, at which point Jackie came into the room, got on her knees, bent down, kissed me deeply just once. How old were you? Because this might have been every dream moment.
Slightly out of context, but I mean, she asked what I was doing after the film, and I was so young and naive. I was 20 at that point.
Okay.
And I said I had to go to L.A. to meet, you know, try and find an agent. She said, oh, well, why don't you stay with me and my boyfriend Alexander? She was living with Alexander Gudinov, this Russian ballet star, and probably the most beautiful couple in the planet. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so she was so gracious to me, and I lived at her home for, I don't know, a month or two while I was out there trying to figure out Hollywood. And yes, there was one moment, but you know, it was probably all I could have taken was one moment. So
that's great for 20, not too bad. Your role in St. Elmo's Fire, it was a great fit for you, and in a role that really did define the stars of what we all called the Brat Pack. I mean, that was the movie that did it.
Yeah, I mean, that role for me was it fit me like glove, you know. I mean, that sort of cynical, rotten before it's ripe kind of jaded worldview, which is just covering up absolute terror and sensitivity, you know. And I identified with that completely, and I just made him my own, you know. And I brought in all the wardrobe. I kind of said, what if he dresses like this? And, you know, because that's just how I dressed.
Right.
And that was a great time because, it was the first time I'd been in a movie where I was aware that, like, oh, I'm doing okay here.
Yeah, you're on your way. You know, absolutely.
Yeah, and I really felt that at the time. I felt like, you know, I was in the right place at the right time in the right job.
What I love about the book, Andrew, is, I mean, I'm getting my fill of all my movies and some behind the scenes, but you tell some great stories, obviously, that none of us have heard before. You talk about after filming St. Elmo's Fire, Rob Lowe invited you and him and his girlfriend, Little House on the Prairie's Melissa Gilbert, for a night out at Spago. You ran into Liza Minnelli, who kept saying she was going to take you all to Sammy's house, and you all thought it was a bar or a restaurant, and it was Sammy Davis.
We were having dinner, and like Liza at the end of dinner says, which was weird enough to sit down and Liza Minnelli is my dinner partner. I'm like, oh, hi, Liza. Yeah. Can I get a double vodka, please? So at the end of dinner, Liza said, hey, what do you say we go to Sammy's? And I thought it was like some nightclub. So I'm like, yeah, definitely. Let's hit Sammy's. Love Sammy's. And anyway, we get in the cars. We drive up into the Hollywood Hills. And I'm like, this is not some club. We pull up in front of this big house. We knock on the door. And who opens it but Sammy Davis Jr. standing there. He goes, hey, cats, come on in. And like we party at Sammy's house. And it was just
holy,
such a
surreal,
crazy time for like, I'm a long way from New Jersey, you know. But you know, it was that time when the old Hollywood was sort of still existed a little bit, and they were so kind and sort of welcoming to us, like into the club, as it were. I mean, Sammy, I'm sitting there with Sammy smoking cigarettes.
Oh,
he's
man.
Looking at me and he's going, you know,
I'm watching you young cats, and I'm loving what I'm seeing. Keep it up. And I'm like, okay, Sammy, you know.
I mean, surreal. I mean, just surreal moments.
Totally surreal. Yeah. And but on the other hand, it was so weird because it is so surreal, and yet it was so normal and benign in a certain way. They were just lovely people sort of welcoming into their world. And but then it's still, it's like, wait, no, I'm talking to Sammy Davis Jr. here.
Yeah,
you know? And those lies over there are going to give me a ride home.
Hello, yeah, absolutely. Goes on, Chicago's John Cusack helmed The Sure Thing in 85, but you auditioned for the same role. And I love how you explained it. You blew the audition by whistling. You know, Rob Reiner, who was casting, just thought you were, what, overconfident? Cocky?
I have no idea. It was such a weird thing because I went in, I auditioned, I did pretty well, and he was very sort of interested. And I walked out, and I remember, and I apparently, which I didn't remember, I started whistling out in the hallway when I got out of the door. And I guess I was feeling pretty good about myself. And I didn't get the part, and I was like, oh, wow, that was weird, because I thought I did really well, and Rob was really excited about me. So, and then 25 years later, I was directing Rob in a television show, and he said, you know, you auditioned for my movie. And I'm like, yeah, and you didn't cast me. Why? You know? And he goes, well, I'll tell you why. And he told me the story. He goes, yeah, you were great. And then when you walked out, I heard you whistling in the hallway, and I thought, nope, he's out. And I'm like, wow. Why?
By the way, and 25 years later, you hear about this.
Yeah.
Pretty in Pink was the big movie. And, you know, you tell some great stories in here, too. You showed up on the first day of filming for Pretty in Pink with glitter on your face.
Yes. I mean, one of the things that happen when you become successful quickly at a very young age in Hollywood is then pretty women suddenly, I became catnip in a certain way, in a way that I had been invisible up to that moment.
Right.
And I was taken to a strip club, and one of the people performing was named Glitter and had some glitter, and I met Glitter after her show. And anyway, so the next day, and glitter is very hard to get off, as you know, and it sort of flies everywhere. And anyway, I had some glitter on my face that was difficult to get off. So,
but that was your life back then. I mean, you were living the life. I mean, that's okay. I mean,
but it was just so weird. Like, again, it was just sort of like the surreal things are happening. And it's just, and on the other hand, it just seems, oh, well, that's just what happened then.
Yeah,
you know, it's just an odd time of being young and sort of, because you don't know any better.
Yeah.
And yet life stuff happens and you go, well, that's just my life.
That's right. A moment in time. Absolutely. You know, Pretty in Pink, you were really not at the top of the list, but Molly Ringwald told John Hughes, yeah, no, this is exactly who we want for this role.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't on any list. I mean, I went into audition. I was given a sort of courtesy audition because I had just been in St. Elmo's Fire, which was about to come out. And the script was for this sort of square-jawed, you know, high school quarterback hunk kind of guy, and I did not fit that bill. And so I went in, I auditioned, and Molly was there reading. And as I walked, you know, John Hughes went, okay, thank you. I read once. They couldn't have cared less. I laughed as I was walking out. I'm like, screw those guys. And then Molly turned to John the second I walked out of the door and said, that's the guy. Mm. And John was like, that wimpy guy? And I was like, yeah, he's dreamy. And John was like, I don't get it. But a testament to John, who did take young people, you know, seriously, he said, if you think so, then I'll go for it. And
pretty cool.
That's totally what happened. Yeah, it was all Molly when I got that part.
Pretty cool. You know, it's kind of famously known that the ending was completely, you know, reshot because you didn't end up together. And you know, it just, things pivot very quickly, especially when an audience reacts to something like that, but it made the movie that much better.
Well, the movie's sort of a fairy tale, really, and it has to, fairy tales have to end in a certain way, you know? I mean, the original ending was we didn't end up together. I just sort of stiff Molly and become this kind of jerk. And then, yeah, they did a test screening, and the audience loved the movie till that moment, and they hated the movie. And Hollywood is smart enough to go, well, they're not going to make any money if they hate the movie.
Yeah, so let's fix that.
They changed the ending, you know, and you know, when we did that, I was in New York doing a play. I'd shaved my head for this play that I was doing, playing a Marine, and so they had to give me a wig, which is this terrible wig. So if you watch that end of that movie now, yeah, I go up and I apologize to Molly and tell her I love her and whatever I said to her. But I'm wearing this really, really cheaply made wig just sort of stuffed on the top of my head. And it gives me a wonderfully forlorn, sad look. So I did a lot of fine wig acting there. It really did 90% of the work for me.
That's awesome. Absolutely awesome. You pivoted to a more peaceful place behind the camera. You directed some major, major hits. Are you more comfortable in that role now rather than in front of the camera, Andrew?
Well, you know, I was for a while, and I've been doing, that's sort of what I do now, that and travel writing. But I do love directing. I mean, I have every actor neuroses there is, so I understand, like, what the situation is. Yeah. So, and I enjoy... I enjoy it a lot. People have asked me the difference. I often say that acting causes anxiety and directing is stressful, and I'd rather be under stress than feeling anxious. Mm. But I acted again recently on a show that I direct, Good Girls, and yeah. It was really quite fun. I hadn't acted in a number of years, and I was surprised how much I enjoyed it again. It's because, you know, at the end of the day, I've acted for so many decades now that it's like that joke of the two fish passing in the water, and one fish says to the other, "Ain't the water fine today?" And the other fish goes, "What water?" I mean, that's sort of how I feel about acting. It's just sort of like, it's just part of who I am, you know?
Great chat, and really, congratulations. I really, really enjoyed the book.
No, thanks very much. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Andrew. All right, news is next here on 720 WGN. All right, Ally Sheedy's career spans classics like The Breakfast Club, St. Elmo's Fire, and War Games to indie hits like High Art, and now she's co-starring in the second season of Freeform comedy series Single Drunk Female as Carol, the wine-loving mom of a newly sober adult daughter. And to talk about the second season is Ally Sheedy. Hi, Ally.
Hi, how are you?
I am good. How many times have you heard... You know, I grew up watching your movies, like part of my teenage years.
I have heard it a few times, but it is always lovely to hear.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's great. Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, I will tell you, this is a super fun series. If folks haven't seen it yet, Single Drunk Female, which must translate into a fun role for you.
I love this character deeply. I love her, and I love getting to play Carol. Yes,
it's
true.
It's like a fun snarkiness between you and your daughter, and you know what? That does happen in real life, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. There's a very contentious relationship going on between them. It's very crackly.
Very crackly, yeah. You know, and here's your character. You know, this the first season, you were rebuilding your own life, the character after losing. Your spouse. So now here your daughter's a mess and then moves in, but we're going to see something pivot a little bit in the second season as she moves back out on her own.
Yeah. At the end of the season, she finds an apartment and for a part of the season, she has moved out because we have an enormous fight and I really hurt her and she leaves. Just basically a 180 from season one, where I wasn't sure that I wanted her in my house. Now that she's moved out, I'm deeply hurt.
You feel it.
Yeah. And I don't want to lose her.
You know, there's great writing on the show, and your character, especially over the last season, showed, you know, a lot more dimensions. It almost like it evolved as the series went on.
Yeah, yes. Carol has a really interesting journey in this season. It's not the same at the end of the 10 episodes as she is at the beginning. And it's complicated. There's a lot of levels of things going on.
I was going to say, it's relatable also on a lot of levels. So, you know, drinking is a huge part of people's lives. And the show has a constant thread in it that it's kind of all about choices, right?
Yes, it is about choices, especially bad ones. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And talking through it and stuff, I'm sure, you know, it's fun to watch. It's funny, but I'm sure people connect to that for that reason.
Yes. And the show is not actually in the second season very much about alcohol at all. It's about figuring out relationships and how do you move forward in your life. And I don't know who this kid is if she's not a drunk or going through her first year of getting sober. Everything's, you know, all about that. Now there's just a lot of repair work that has to go on in the relationship between Carol and Samantha.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah. Moving forward. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've heard you talk about the fact that you embrace writers and producers that are women, as they often have lived through something and their writing shares that experience and it feels real. And those are the kind of roles that call out to you, especially this one.
Yes, because I love Simone Finch, who created this show, and I am playing her actual mother. Right. So in the beginning, in the first season, Carol was so real to me because she's real. I mean, it's Simone lived this kind of relationship with her mother. And in this season, the most essential relationship in my life as Carol speaking is with my daughter. Mm-hmm. That's the most essential relationship. And I don't know how to have a relationship with her. And I do something really destructive to her and drive her away. And it throws me into a state of incredible pain. And I got to figure out what am I going to do to fix that relationship? And it ends up meaning that Carol actually has to change, when it's always been the whole time that the problem's the daughter,
not yours,
the
right,
daughter
right,
has to change. Right. Right? And mm-hmm. suddenly it's, wait a minute, she's sober and doing this program and whatever she's doing. And obviously I am like a force for chaos and I don't know why. Right.
Right. Exactly. Well, I almost feel like, you know, in season one, it really did establish the characters, the relationships. And now that journey continues into sobriety and having a new job and a new love interest and throwing herself a party. So it really is about moving on and finding that next goal in life.
Yeah, I think so. And also it's, I haven't seen before, and I was trying to work on this. We all know the stories of an alcoholic that gets sober, or a drug addict that gets clean, and that's a particular journey. Mm-hmm. But what Carol has to do in this is much more in the, we call it friends and family, but it's much more like this Al-Anon territory.
Okay.
And so I don't think that's as much fun to watch. But at the same time, I took that very seriously when we were filming. What is that? Well, you have to go in and figure out, wait, what's wrong? It's not all about the alcoholic. There's a lot of, you have to start looking at yourself.
Yeah, very true. Very true.
And understanding like how you're still actually relating to that person who's no longer drinking as if they are. There is all of these different levels that were going on. Yeah. I just want it to be true.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, that's very, very interesting. And I also know there's a little mini Breakfast Club reunion happening this season as well. I've seen pics.
Right.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yes. Molly Ringwald comes in for one of the episodes. We're sisters-in-law in the series. And she comes in a kind of a flashback scene, and it was wonderful.
Two of my three are teenage kids, and they've watched it because I feel like that's a rite of passage. And,
right.
You know, people talk about, you have to look at the film about the time it was made. You know, so if there's any, I don't know, they call them cringeworthy moments and so forth. You got to remember.
There are.
Like, yeah, but you got to remember when it was filmed. Like, it was a little bit different. And if you recognize it, then you could be all good with it, right?
Yeah, I think there are some things in that film that I mean, I know because I know the film so well, right, that are relevant. And even when I think back on the story of the film and we were doing it, there are some things that are just not really relevant today, or that just don't feel like I don't know about that. Yeah. So it's a mixed bag. I'm glad that people still love it. And I truly understand the flaws and weaknesses that are there.
It happens. Now, are you still teaching, by the way?
Yes.
Are you really? Oh, did you really? Yeah. That's awesome. And then, City College of New York, is that where you're at?
Yeah. City College. I honestly, that was the first half of my day today.
Wow.
Yeah. I was teaching. Uh-huh.
So do your students recognize you, or at least Google you to see
yeah,
who
they
you
Google me.
Do they?
For sure, they do. Some students recognize me. I at the moment seem to have a kind of, this is my, I started teaching in 2018.
Wow.
So, now at this point, I know that kids are signing up for my class because they've heard that it's a good class. And I think it's a good class.
Excellent. Okay, cool. Yeah.
So we talk a lot about, film sets and things that I had to learn on the job that I just want to give to them. But it's about their work and their scenes and learning how to work in front of a camera.
You must love that.
I love it.
Yeah, I bet you do.
I love it and I love them.
Oh, that's great. That's awesome. Well, you can catch Ally Sheedy on the new season of Single Drunk Female on Freeform. Ally Sheedy, thanks so much for joining us. That was fun.
Thank you. Thanks for speaking.